Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and our topic today is fraud, which comes in various forms and can affect individuals, businesses, and governments worldwide. The financial cost of fraud to victims can be substantial, encompassing losses from direct monetary theft, legal fees, investigation costs, and reputation damage. As many of you might suspect, the fastest growing is cyber fraud and cybercrime, which encompasses a wide range of criminal activities conducted online, such as phishing scams, identity theft, ransomware attacks, and fraudulent online purchases. The financial cost of cyber fraud to victims worldwide is now estimated to be in the hundreds of billions of dollars annually. It's just almost unimaginable. Another area is insurance fraud, which involves individuals and organizations making false or exaggerated claims for financial gain. The annual cost of insurance loss is globally estimated at over $40 billion, which affects all of us because we're going to end up paying for it either through increased premiums or increased cost in some ways. Investment scams are also on the rise, and it involves deceptive practices in financial markets, such as Ponzi schemes, which we've all heard of, but there's also pump and dump schemes, insider trading, fraudulent investment offers. The financial impact of investment fraud, it varies worldwide depending on the scale of schemes, but it can result in losses from thousands of dollars to some people to billions of dollars for individual investors and institutional investors. There's healthcare fraud that a lot of people don't think about, but it affects all of us in the sense that we're going to have increased healthcare costs and reduced quality of care. Corporate fraud and white collar crime, they're also on the rise. This affects businesses, it affects organizations, and it can be through accounting fraud, embezzlement, bribery, or corruption. And the financial impact on this is estimated at also in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So, and this can affect shareholders, employees, stakeholders, and the fallout from corporate fraud, it can also affect your company from the standpoint of legal penalties, regulatory fines, and just damage to your corporate reputation. Now, I wish I was able to say right now, April Fools, but you know what? Unfortunately, I can't. Those numbers are true. What I can and I will do is I will bring on our guests to discuss how we can deal with this. Mike LaCourte, who is an industry leader in the international investigation space with over 25 years experience, starting as an investigator and then co-founding Conflict International Investigations. He's a fellow past president of the World Association of Detectives, which is the oldest and largest global organization of its kind with approximately 1,000 members in approximately 80 countries. Now today, April Fool's Day in some countries, we'll be discussing how to not get fooled in our ever-changing world of technology, AI, and an increasing amount of scammers out there. So without further ado, Mike, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you being here, and I know that in Europe, or at least in England, you guys are on holiday, so I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, correct. It's bank holiday today. It is April Fool's, but the fool is only before 12 o'clock, as I'm talking.
So anyway, before we get to some of our listener questions, share a little bit about some of the areas that Conflict International helps companies and individuals around the world.
Sure. Thank you. So we're a full service investigation and intelligence agency, HQ'd in London, UK, with other auxiliary offices throughout the US and Europe. And the team is about 25 full-time investigators that cover a range of investigation solutions, from tracing individuals to doing deep dive due diligence reports, background checks, investigating fraud. I know you mentioned those statistics, which are pretty staggering, but we have a whole team that investigate all types of fraud, internal surveillance teams, risk management teams, and on a global level through our network, as you mentioned earlier with the World Association of Detectives, we have strategic partners, let's say, service level agreements, investigators, boots on the ground in those difficult jurisdictions around the globe where investigating maybe not as follows the normal steps that we do in the West. So having those strategic partnerships formed with other professionals enables us to investigate on a global level.
Well, and I think what I'd like to do is just kind of start with, you know, some of the key red flags that indicate a potential fraudster or scammer in international transactions. And one of the reasons why I'm so happy to have you here is I've dealt with some of these things, and it's usually more on a California level or a U.S. level. I think it takes it to another level when we start talking about international transactions. Why do you think, what are some of the key red flags for people when they're contacted by somebody that should make them kind of stand up and take notice before moving forward?
Yeah, and you know, like you said, fraud has evolved and changed now, and I've seen it over the past 25 years in terms of capability, the way the fraudsters operate now as they did back then. But you've got to remember the one main fact. In any fraud transaction, it's usually unsolicited. So you get contacted by a third party. You're not the one that's reaching out. It's the fraudster that's reaching you, generally under some urgency and time pressure as well. So you need to do this so that this can happen. We've got a short window opportunity for you to click on this link or make a payment or what have you, because we're going to lose this high value investment deal. There's always some sense of urgency. And the steps in, let's call it layered fraud, because it's winning trust over a period of time. Fraudsters are clever and they adapt and they will win you and phase a fraud over a period of time. So whereas before the old traditional 419 scams, where they would send millions of emails and someone would click on a link and send a payment. Right. Now, fraudsters are targeting, we're finding more so, fraudsters investing in the research and targeting their victim. So anything that doesn't seem normal, urgency, unusual payment methods, send money via Western Union, Bitcoin, or something that's not right in terms of your everyday business, especially when you're dealing on a global level. These deals are too good to be true. You know, this fantastic investment that's going to give you 20 times your money that you've never heard of, you know, just if you do X or if you pay me X up front. Those too good to be true deals are usually too good to be true. So trying to, you know, if something feels so far that's not normal, those are the red flags you need to look out for. But generally, you're unsolicited at the beginning. So you're targeted, you're approached first, and you're asked to do certain steps to follow. And that's the fraudster putting you in this position of trust. And once they get you in the position of trust, it's the layering.
And you brought up a point right in the beginning when you said, when they say, well, just click here. Talk a little bit about where the fraud that you're more concerned about, you're looking out for that one, that person who's going to ask you to send money. And you're like, no, I'm not going to send money. But in essence, what they're saying is, we just want you to click here. Explain a little bit how that's sort of they got you worried about this one, but then when you click, that's actually how they're taking your information.
So these phishing scams is what they're called. They're phishing your information. And there, it may be a link. It may be through an SMS message with a link inside that message, pretending to be from DHL, for example, or any other of these couriers that as a package come into your house, click on this and enter your personal details. It could be that. It could be the cleverer ones are websites that look like a conventional website, but they're fake. So let's say, for example, and I'm just using a bank and as examples, let's say Bank of America. For the A is a Cyrillic A, so from a Cyrillic alphabet. So when you look at the URL, it looks like bankofamerica.com. You click on it, it looks exactly like bankofamerica.com. However, the A or one of the letters could be a Cyrillic letter, different, and it's a carbon copy of Bank of America's website. You've clicked on there, and you've typed in your login details for your bank account, for example, and those that information is captured, a third party can then access your account. So that, you know, what I'm saying is fraud has evolved, and the criminal networks that are targeting victims and vulnerable people have invested heavily in how to trick and how to get past this trust layering with the victims.
Well, which takes us right to the question of, you know, how can individuals or companies protect themselves from this type of identity theft or impersonation or things where they're gathering this information through communication? You know, I mean, how can we protect ourselves? Because eventually, as you said, be it Bank of America or Wells Fargo or whatever, we, you know, we want to hear from them if somebody's out there trying to tap into our account, and somebody contacts us and they're like, we're the fraud department of Wells Fargo. Okay. I'm happy that they're looking out for me. Let's talk about how can we protect ourselves from that? I've got some ideas, but now, you know, if you protect, or you assume that I'm just a client that's calling in, or somebody out there, how can they protect themselves from that situation where you feel like if you don't give them the information, somebody's out there stealing your money right now?
Yeah, and again, you know, depends where this fraud attack attempt is coming from. I would definitely educate yourself with the types of frauds that are out there and set up what's called MFA, multi-factor authentication. So most people used to use or still use 2FA, so two-factor authentication, which means if somebody, if you're logging into your email or if you're logging into your bank account, it sends you a text message as a second layer of protection. Go for MFA, multi-factor authentication, because it's more difficult for a fraudster or a hacker to access your account because they're not going to have all of the verification tools at hand, not going to have access to everything that you've got. So definitely skill up on your knowledge in the types of fraud that are available out there. Try and protect yourself in terms of multi-factor authentication. So your passwords and a second means of verification. For example, the call you said from the bank, right. Well, you know, cut that call and call them back, you know, call them back from the proper number. So try and, you know, verify the identity of the individual that you're communicating with. Be skeptical. It's simple, right? Stay informed, stay up to date, be inquisitive, question. Don't take everything as it is at face value. Not that you are going to live your life scared of being tricked. It should be just common practice. You wouldn't just give someone £100 or $100 in the street. So just think of your processes as it's happening and try and minimize that risk. You know, the onus is put on the victim a lot to try and defend themselves. But if you have the right skills and be aware of what's out there, you'll be able to, that red flag and that this doesn't seem quite right alarm bell, that's what you're trying to trigger. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, look, I've seen the scams and I know that some of them are very good, very creative, and they pass the trust test, and it puts the victim in a position where they've got nowhere else to turn and it seems genuine. So I know it can be difficult, but the low-hanging fruit ones, keep yourself protected. Stay informed, be skeptical, and just verify as much as you can.
Yeah, and for everybody out there, I mean, the first thing that Mike said that's very important is the multi-factor authentication. So if you set that up, and this person calls you and you can say, well, that's interesting because I didn't get a text. So the way that I set up my multi-factor authentication, I didn't get a text. Why is that? And then let them stammer a little bit about, you know, because they're probably not prepared for that question and they'll probably just hang up and try and get somebody else. So anyway, a great point. One of the things that I'm told on this show that people love is real life examples. So Mike, share a case or two, maybe some of your favorites, to where you've been contacted and fortunately contacted in time to where you were able to either keep the fraud from happening, or after it happened, at least able to catch the people that did it and hopefully be able to make the client whole.
Okay. What we've seen, especially after the pandemic or during the pandemic, is a huge rise in romance scams. A lot of people are online continuously, and there's, you know, when you're online a lot, and I've seen, you know, some very professional people get caught up in a romance scam, and one individual, I'll keep it as sterile as possible, but based right. in Canada, actually sent quite a substantial amount of money to a team. He thought he was dealing with a particular individual, and for the best part, he was. The individual was a front for the criminal gang, and he ended up sending, you know, a six-figure sum. The money dissipated. It came into Europe and then headed into the Far East. However, through some investigation work, we got the police involved. We ended up identifying two of the main fraudsters that were behind it, and we actually went to speak to them. And when you uncover the layers of fraud and deception and deceit and get down to the raw detail of exactly what's happened, and I was one of the investigation team that actually spoke to the fraudsters, showed them the evidence that we had, and said, look, this is getting handed over to authorities if you don't pay back what you've taken. And the fraudster, with as much front as you like, and his wife, it was a team, it was a couple, said, well, your client was stupid enough to send the money. So with that, we went straight to the authorities with our reports. They were arrested, actually, and charged. And the client got back a percentage of his money because they bought a brand new car and that was taken back. And they ended up going to prison for a period of time. However, the client still got pulled through 24 months of hell, still was, you know, tricked, and went through this emotional roller coaster journey to try and get to the end. But if you look at the fraud in the beginning, it was very, very simple. And the client was tricked in thinking he was speaking to someone that he wasn't. And it was all done remotely via video camera and whatever else. A whole character was built. And the client was deceived. And that was a personal, you know, individual being defrauded by the fraudster. And when I say it's the fraudster, it's not one particular fraudster. There's a team. It's organized crime. It's an organized criminal team. You've got the guys who know how to do the IT side of it. You've got the front people that are great with the communication. You've got the back enders that are monitoring and seeing, let's push this fraud. Let's keep it going. How do we put the victim in a position where their option is to pay? How do we keep them in that I need to pay position? How do we keep it going? So it's an organized criminal gang. It's not a keyboard warrior. We've got to remember that. And they have resources. They will have knowledge of the banking world, the financial world, the way things operate, how to get you through these layers of trickery and keep you in that position of payment. I'll give you another example, Alan, if you like. I've got a business example where...
Yeah, please do.
And this is more and more common. It's dealing with someone in accounts. If you know any type of company that are using, say, paying a lot of invoices, setting up email addresses that are very similar to an email address that's continuously sending invoices to or invoicing the client for, and then changing the bank details on that invoice. So having the letters sent into the accounts department of a particular company saying, as of April the 1st or as of this particular date, our banking details have changed. Please, can you send further remittance to this account? And that's the fraudsters creating, pretending to be a subcontractor for the company, and then changing those payment details on future subcontracted invoices so that all payments don't go to the real subcontractor, it goes to the fraud bank account. And, you know, that happens as well. And in that, it's training, putting provisions in place. And these frauds are looking for low-hanging fruit. You know, someone who's sitting in accounts, processing payments all day, may be vulnerable in you know, making that mistake.
You know, in a situation like that, and I'm trying to visualize it now, what are some of the things that you can do, because and I know that you have conflict, there are things that you can put in place for some of these businesses that make that far less likely to be able to happen?
Usually with businesses, I know it sounds, prevention is better than the cure. And usually companies come to us when it's gone wrong. We've been defrauded, we've been scammed. How can you help? What do we need to do? So we try and get in ahead of the game. And if we can put awareness and training out there and the psychology that goes behind what employees are doing when they're communicating with third parties, that will mitigate some of the risk that comes in from these opportunist type frauds. If you are going to be targeted properly, then that is a different scenario. That needs, there's an array of services from protecting your IT infrastructure right up to training staff. But usually the companies come to us when it's gone wrong. One of the, and we do this throughout the year for a variety of clients, is we test the staff team. So let's say at Christmas party time, we will send, we will pretend to be from the company. Now, the board will have full knowledge of this, and we will send a invite email to all of the staff across the whole company, across the whole of the client's company, saying, hi, guys, Christmas party this year. We're meeting at X wine bar. I would love you to come. It's going to be from 6 till 8. If you're going to come, just fill in your name, your telephone number, your address on this email that's sent to all of the staff, your date of birth or whatever else. And we will try and see how many people click on the link from the email. That's number one, right? So your staff have clicked on a link they shouldn't have. And secondly, how much personal data do members of staff type into the email? Their name, their date of birth, their whatever, their position at the work, you know, as much information, and submit it. And then at the Christmas party, one of the investigators will go with a quick presentation and say, we're not mentioning any names, but 68% of you clicked on this link that could have been a fraudulent link. And actually, 30-odd percent of you put your date of birth in, your name, your social security number, your home address. And so just to try and educate and bring the awareness out. And it is it becomes a fun way to train staff subliminally, because I think everyone needs to think, you know. But I'm really on that prevention is better than the cure. However, a lot of companies out there consider that as an expense and really come and do something when it's gone wrong.
Yeah, and I think that's such a great point. And I've also said that for years is, you know, you can pay a little bit now for prevention, or it's going to hit really hard if you don't. So we're going to take a break. But for everybody out there, you're listening to or you're watching Answers Network, we'll be right back. If you know somebody that can benefit from this, send them out a message right now and tell them to tune in. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practice lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. We're speaking with Mike LaCourte, and we are talking about fraud. And unfortunately, this is not a April Fool's joke. This is something that's really going on. So, Mike, what we were talking about before we went to break, you mentioned in regards to romance fraud. I'm going to share just a little bit of a story in regards to that, because I want to touch on the fact that, you know, we can all talk about the financial aspect of this, you know, where people are sending in money. But the emotional aspect of this, and I say that because that on a case that I worked on, I was hired by the family because it was, they learned that their in this case, their sister, had sent over $150,000 to a man that she had never met. And so they contacted me when I did the investigation, just as you would. We were able to tie in things like the picture. The picture came from a guy in, I think he was in Pennsylvania. And he was very upset because people were going after him. And it was a picture that was just taken off of his Facebook page. So it wasn't him. But through various algorithms and such, which I know that you're able to do, we were able to determine that there were 10 other women that had gotten similar letters. And I think this is something for people to understand. If you're getting this contact from somebody, there are ways that we can figure out that you're not the only person getting this. Well, by putting this together, we were also able to track the money, and the money, she could have sworn that she was sending it to him and he was in a particular European country. And in reality, the money went through London to Turkey to the Ukraine. And at that point, so even being able to try to go back to the bank in London and see if there was something to do, it was already gone. So they're already planning ahead by moving the money as quickly as possible. But the emotional part for this woman, I ended up going and seeing her. She was in a particular location that I had to go to see, and I had to get permission to be able to see her. And she just broke down crying. And she said, emotionally, it was all just too much for her, because over such a period of time, she was so looking for love that the fact that somebody would do this to her and take advantage of her emotionally like this was more than she could take. So again, we're as investigators, we're talking about the financial loss. The emotional loss sometimes is so much worse. You want to share a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, completely. And you hit that perfectly with the emotional loss. I've had cases where we've proved that the situation is fraudulent, but the victim will still continue to send money. For someone that's not in that environment, doesn't understand that, but they want to believe this relationship so much, they're willing to keep going and are content with this world of interaction with this third party that they have been communicating with for a while, and they want to keep that relationship going. And that is, as an investigator, you we're here to investigate and fact find, get the truth, and bring some resolve. With romance scams or emotionally connected scams, you've got to be mindful of the individual involved as well. So there's that side that runs concurrently with the fraud. Yeah,
it's obviously it's one of the most insidious and saddest things. We have a question that's come in from a listener. And again, I want to take this time to thank those of you that take the time. Oftentimes, it's people that work in the middle of the day, so they send them in either the night before. But again, we thank you. This one reads, our retired mother invested most of her life savings with some company that called her on the phone. She wired 80,000 euros from her bank to them. We now can't get in touch. And then in parentheses, it says the phone number is disconnected. Local law enforcement claims there's nothing they can do. He lives in Italy. We're in the U.S. Any idea what we can do? And this is from Cassandra in Highland Park, Illinois.
Okay. Well, firstly, I'm sorry that your mother fell victim to an international scam like that. As an investigator, I need to see the facts, and we can work out what's the best way to tackle this. And it was $80,000, you said?
80,000 euros.
So, again, authorities, law enforcement, for, and this is a big amount for a lot of people, but for you know, to mobilize a law enforcement investigation team, €80,000, you're not going to get a lot of traction without, you know, with being fair to the public sector. However, we would look at what information do you have? How were they contacted? Now you said you have a phone number. That's great. Where did you send the money to? What name did you send the money to? That may give us some leads. Is the phone number a landline, mobile? Doesn't matter if it's been disconnected or not. We can still interrogate and see what research we can or information we can find out about it. The name, is it connected to the number? Is the name connected to any other business entities? Italy, why? What was the investment about? Some sort, some more information about why you sent the money. And was it only by phone they communicated? Do you have any other documentation, paperwork, or anything that you've got that we can assess and have a look and see what the best way to tackle this is? A lot of these fraudsters use middle countries. So it's the three bank rule, really, that if you wire money to one country or bank and then move it on a couple of times, it makes jurisdictional enforcement an issue or difficult. And tracing down the individuals behind it even more so. Sometimes these fraudulent groups use money mules, people that are unaware of the fraud that's been committed, but are just used as a bank account to receive the money, take a percentage, and then give that money to the criminal gang. So when you do trace down the individual that
right
received them, they're unaware of it. They're unaware, completely unaware. So, you know, they're, again, we can assess something like that and work out what's the least path of resistance to try and find out whether we can identify who's behind it. But then we may be able to do that. The most important part is recovery, right? You want your money back. Right. So how do we go about doing that? And that's a whole different type of investigation and it's a case strategy, really.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned about the money mule, and I think it's a great point to bring up. I think most of us, at least if you know in business, we get those emails that say, "Hey, we're a big company in China, and we're doing business now in the United States. But because of the difficulty to be able to transfer money over here, we'd like to partner with you and have these companies pay directly to you, just like you said." You know, and you know, you're going to get 10% or whatever. You're going to take the money in. You're going to then pass it on to us. That looks great, doesn't it? I mean, it's like, this is great. I get to do nothing and I'm going to make 10%. And they make it sound like they're going to be passing, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars through you. That's, you know, in other words, just that sheer fact right there is understand you're being used and you're probably going to be the one caught in the middle holding the bag, because what happens is then that U.S. company that now is trying to sue, they paid into you. All of a sudden, they're going to freeze your accounts. And if you're running it through your account, guess what? Whatever else you have in there, it's all frozen until they figure out what to do. So anyway, it's be very careful. Do the preventative things before you do that. Because again, as Mike just said in the very beginning, if it looks too good to be true, probably is. I'm checking the time real quick. If we're going to talk a little bit about to businesses. So for those of you, you know, if you're running a business out there, Mike, what are some of the best practices for verifying the authenticity of international businesses or partners before engaging in financial transactions?
Okay, big question. And, you know, if you're used to doing international work, you would have some sort of DD or KYC process in place. If you're not and you're looking to venture out internationally, then I would suggest that you take the time to educate yourself in what's out there. Or if you can't internally do that, then hire some professionals that can help you. But number one, KYC, always know your client. So know your client. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is if you're approached by an international party to do to buy from you or to trade with you or to co-invest or whatever the scenario the deal is, make sure you verify who you're dealing with via more than one mean of via more than one way. So, you know, if you've been unsolicited or solicited, sorry, by email or telephone call, that's fine. Get the information, go online separately. I know it sounds very simple, but just do some open source stuff. Just verify what's out there. Put their name in and write the word scam. Put their name in and write the word fraud in Google. Just see what comes up. I mean, yeah. very, you'd be surprised the amount of cases that we take on, and, you know, people go straight for the deep, dark, crazy investigation path straight away. Now, start with the low-hanging fruit. Start with the easiest things right. first. Just search it on Google, just you know, and see what pops up. Make yourself comfortable that you've verified who you're dealing with. And then you can take it a little bit step further. Depending on the jurisdiction, what country it is, there may be corporate records that you can get. The difference between Europe and the US is corporate records, financial records for companies are very accessible in Europe. So if you're dealing with someone, if you're a US company and you're dealing with someone in Europe, you can generally go to most European companies' house equivalents and grab the directors, the shareholders, financial information, and it's open source. I know that's slightly different in the US, that information is protected, but in Europe, financial corporate data is quite open and available. And a lot of people in the US don't know that. So do that check, pull their last few years' accounts, see if it's a trading entity, see if the individual that says he's the CEO, director, shareholder of that company is actually registered in that company. And then if you've been communicating via email with this individual, check the name and the email that exists to the company. See if it's on the website. Google the email. You know, there's a lot of investigation, let's say, basic investigation tools that you can do yourself without hiring the professionals. I mean, if you hire a professional, they're going to go through it thoroughly. But you can do these initial checks yourself and see what pops up.
Well, and let's talk about that then, because I agree. And I tell people the same, you know, as you called it, low-hanging fruit. You know, you can run those things yourself. But let's talk about the, you know, the kind of the businesses that are out there that they just want a good, thorough due diligence investigation because they're doing business in so many different countries or with so many different other companies that they just want a good due diligence. Talk a little bit about what that entails and why it's so valuable.
Sure. So there's two types of due diligence, DD type checks that companies can do. One is consented and the other is non-consented. So if a company is going to trade and do business with a third party, then you could opt for the consented check. Now, what I mean by that is the third party signs an authorization to say, yes, I want to do business with you. Feel free to check us out. You have my permission. So that, you know, that should take away a lot of the red flags. If you had red flags before dealing with this third party and they've signed an authorization to say, yeah, check me out. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. We want to do business with you. We want to trade with you. I've got no issue with you checking our company to make sure we're legitimate. Then that for you should think, This is good. Now, doesn't mean that you don't. Yeah, you still do the checks, right? So yeah. That's where we would come in and do the consented checks, and that would be from criminal to credit to financials to litigation, court records, referencing. There's a whole list of checks that get done, and it's a report with a one page exec summary of any red flags and all of the backing behind it, and that should give you enough, let's say, information to make a decision. The non consented check is checks without the third party knowing you're doing them, right? And in that scenario, it could be for a variety of reasons that you want to do that. You may look at buying a company, merger and acquisition, or you might want to invest in this particular company, or there may be a further deal that you're doing that you don't necessarily want them to know because you're doing it for a different reason rather than having it out in the open. And those checks can be done too. And again, access to information in different countries around the world, there's different laws, different privacy laws that, you know, you need to comply with. But generally, those are the two checks that are available, and they're thorough, and there's a deep dive that can be done as well. And it's not also what's available via databases, because in some jurisdictions, the databases are not as strong as they are in the US. You may need to do some field inquiries. We may have to deploy boots on the ground to do some reputation checks. Do you know company XYZ? Have they defaulted in payment? Do we know anyone that was working there that's no longer working there that we could speak to? So there's some field work that's potentially available to us. There could be third parties that this company's done business with that we could go and speak to. We could buy from this company as test purchasing. So go through that particular journey, you know, as we were the client, and see what service we get. So there's a whole array of tools available to us, and we will deploy what's proportionate and necessary to give you peace of mind.
And you touched on another point of the different laws in different jurisdictions. And I think that's really important in the sense that by being an international company, you have to be aware of all of those things. And I know that, for instance, I get questions from other investigators that are in different states that'll ask about things. But one of the problems that they're running into is if you don't know the law of where you're going to or where you're getting that, you can get in greater trouble over, again, things that we can pull here in the United States. It may be illegal in a particular European country, but yet the investigator here thinks, hey, I can do it legal here. And they go over and do that. And now all of a sudden, they're getting sued. You as their client are getting sued. You know, everybody's getting sued. And you've got a bigger headache than you ever envisioned, and all you wanted to do was find somebody or something. So talk a little bit about that and why it's so important to know the laws of each jurisdiction so that you don't dig that hole.
Oh, completely. So, you know, it's understanding what you can and can't do around the globe as an investigator. There may be things you can do from your desk, so you may be able to search local registries, databases, what have you. But anything further, I mean, if you think, I'll fly to wherever and do those inquiries, it's a big deal. I'll do those inquiries myself. I will, speak to third parties, take some pictures. There's different data laws, data privacy laws around the globe. And also there's licensing and regulation, right? The same as, you know, the US, there's lots of states that are licensed. In Europe, there are countries that are licensed. So, and, you know, if you cross yourself into that on the line of what I can and can't do into what you can't do and put yourself in a position, then, like Alan said, you're just setting yourself up for creating a problem that wasn't there initially. So you need to understand what's possible, what's legally possible, understand what tools you have available to you in different countries, because you may be able to do some of it yourself, but you may need to, you know, contract someone who's an expert there. And the other thing, data privacy and law is one thing. The other thing is culture. Culture and cultural differences in countries vary too. And for example, there could be festivities, religious holidays, and you're in a country where there's a religious festival or holiday going on, and you're doing inquiries that would be deemed to be inappropriate or unethical or against local culture. You need to educate and understand.
Great point.
What you can and can't do during the year as well. I know it may sound really, but it does, especially when you're dealing with, say, the Middle East or the Far East, where there are big cultural differences. What your small little inquiry you think is okay could have been really offensive to the company that you may have a long-term business relationship with. So you need to be aware of that as well. And that's why contacting someone who has a network and has reliable, trusted boots on the ground, knowledgeable partners around the globe, is especially if your inquiry requires that level of investigation, then you need to have the right team to do that for you.
You know, I was smiling when you said that because it reminded me of a cultural mistake that I made, I want to say about 40 years ago, but went into an Asian country and I went in with another investigator who was a little more seasoned than I. And we sat down and we were liaisoning with someone else. And you know, I shook hands and then I immediately started going in and they had said, oh, you know, we're going to go here and have lunch and we're going to do this and that. And I immediately started in on the case. Well, here's what we need to find out and so on and so forth. And the guy with me, he kicked me under the table, meaning shut the hell up.
Yep.
And the people we were trying to get information from, they kind of shut down for a little bit and he took over for a while. And then we went out to eat and we did everything. And later on, and he said, you don't understand. He said, they were not going to deal with us or give us any information until after we broke bread together. That is their culture. That is how they were going to do it. And you're insulting them by not doing that first. Okay. So, you know, again, this is 40 years ago. I didn't know that. But again, when you brought up culture, that's the first thing I thought of was, you know, the mistakes that we make when we don't know.
Completely. And, you know, Alan, is being part of, say, the WAD, the World Association of Detectives, all these cultures around the world, 80 odd different countries, 1,000 members, going to those events and networking with other investigators, breaking bread, like you said, with other investigators from around the globe, educates you as an investigator, as an international investigator, in the cultural differences that we all have. And that is just as important with doing the investigation.
Absolutely. And I just looked at the time. We've got about 2 minutes and we have another listener question that came in and it says, our 19-year-old daughter is planning to travel the world this summer with two of her friends before starting college in September. Her father and I are very concerned as to her safety. When we discuss it with her, she replies, oh, don't worry, I'll be fine. What can we do to help her keep safe without making her feel that we don't trust her? And this is from Margaret in Akron, Ohio.
Okay. Hi, Margaret. Do my best to answer in 2 minutes. There's a lot we can do, but I would imagine the most basic things to do is have some sort of location device, if she would like an app or something. There's many out there that you know where her phone is. If she's going to get local SIM card, doesn't matter. It will still register. So at least you have some idea on her location. You're not going to track her because I think a teenager may, or, you know, a daughter may become a bit, that might be a bit intrusive, let's say, but tracking preloaded prepaid money cards, credit cards that can be used in Europe. So not linked to anything to her bank account or your bank account for that matter. So there's a limit that you will put on a preloaded card that will be used and that you can top up as you go. If she has some sort of itinerary, agree to have some check-in dates and times if she doesn't want to be tracked. So you know that she's at a particular hotel, Airbnb, accommodation, from what day to what day. So you've got some idea and have an agreed checking time. So I'm here, Mum, fine, and that may be enough. Because one of the scams that goes on with travellers is her number may be, I'm not saying it's going to be, but it has happened before where they're intercepted and a communication comes to you, Mum, I've lost my phone, I need some money, can you send it to me on this particular card? And it's a third party that's pretending to be, you know, your daughter. We don't want that to happen. So try and, again, MFA, I said it right at the beginning, multi-factor authentication. Have an agreed plan. Try and communicate more than one way with your child. So at least then, if one of the communication methods fail, you've got two or three others that you can try and keep on comms. If she's with a group of friends, make sure they all do it. Because if one's out, just get them all to do it. It's a team.
It's a great point. And I'm glad that you brought up that particular scam, because that's another growing scam. And I get people that are calling me saying, hey, I don't know what to do. I just got a call from, you know, my brother-in-law or from some relative. I didn't even know they were going to that country, you know, and things like that. So unfortunately, it's happening more and more. So Mike, I really appreciate you taking the time. As I said, you know, I know it's a holiday out there. We've only scratched the surface, but for anybody out there, if you have more questions, if you go to conflictinternational.com, there's going to be a lot of information that's right there on the website, or you can get in contact with somebody at that point, wherever it is that you may be having a need. If conflict can't provide it for you, they're going to know somebody there that's going to be able to take care of it. Mike, any closing words or anything?
Thank you, Alan. Thank you for running an excellent talk show. And again, if anyone needs any help, Alan's got my details, conflictinternational.com. I'm more than happy to look at any inquiries that you may have or any questions or if you want to take the discussion further. But yeah, fraud is huge. I'm happy to provide any input I can.
All right. And if you're out there, if you're driving, don't worry that you can't write down all of these things. We'll make sure that we have it in the show notes. So again, Mike, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your evening, being as it's you're a few hours ahead. And we will talk again soon.
Thank you. Take care now.
All right. Take care. And for everybody out there, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure that you click the like button. Okay. And if you're interested in seeing more content like this, make sure you subscribe to the show and check out some of our other shows on our channel, on our website, which is answers.network, or any other major social platform. You'll find us there. Next week, we're joined by Sydney Williams as she discusses her new book, Hiking My Feelings, and how a few secrets about nature can dramatically improve all areas of your health. So that concludes our episode for today. Thanks for tuning in. And for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.